Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. In the late 50s, philosopher Guy Debord inspired a merry band of anarcho-socialist artists, who eventually became known as the Situationists. They spun a post-Marxist strategy for fighting back against the encroachment of what they called the spectacle. One of their first targets was the banality and soul-destroying aspects of urban architecture through the investigation of what they called psychogeography. In order to investigate and fight back against the routinization of daily life in cities, they created a psychogeographical research method called the derivé. Take a map and choose a random location, roll some dice, and have the dice determine the direction that you walk from your starting point. Roll dice again to determine the distance you will walk. Then repeat for the next leg of the journey. On a derivé, you would see parts of a city that you would never have seen before, and in a wholly new way. The Situationists said that a democratically governed city should have a conscious urban design that created intentional emotional states in its different quarters, rather than inflicting random oppressiveness. According to Debord, quote, "Architecture is the simplest means of articulating time and space, of modulating reality, of engendering dreams. It is a matter not only of plastic articulation and modulation expressing an ephemeral beauty, but of a modulation producing influences in accordance with the eternal spectrum of human desires and the progress in realizing them." The idea is actually an old one, and experiments in utopian urban design go back centuries in the West. One of the largest and most utopian experiments in intentional, democratic, and spiritual urban design is being conducted in India, in a village called Auroville. Auroville was founded by devotees of a religious teacher, Sri Aurobindo, and his student known as the Mother, and has slowly grown since its conception in 1966 to become an international community of 1,600 people. My guest today is a resident of Auroville, Wim Aspasla. Wim is an educator focusing on the interrelationships of spirituality, economic development, social justice, and ecology. He has been teaching and working in the U.S., Europe, Sri Lanka, Japan, Armenia, and Africa. Wim, who was Sri Aurobindo, and what did he have to do with the founding of Auroville?
Well, Sri Aurobindo was an English-educated Indian. He was born in Calcutta, north of India, and went to England for his education and came back in the early 1900s. And he was one of the first, he was actually one of the first person that spoke out against the English imperialism, the occupation. And really, he created a magazine where he wrote his opinions about the English occupation. And very early, around 1907, he was arrested and spent 1 year in prison. And there he was mostly in solitary confinement. And there he had all kind of spiritual experiences. And when he came out, before being really the liberator of India, afterwards he really had realized certain things that he said, okay, India will be free at one point, but this is not my task. My task is another task. So from an liberation fighter and a politician, he retreated and in Pondicherry, which is in at that time still protectorate, a French protectorate. And that's where he settled and stayed till his passing away in 1950. And from the time 1914 till 1950, he wrote a lot of books and looked at the old Indian tradition and created his own philosophy, which is called Integral Yoga. And and very much the essence of that yoga is that humans are part of an evolutionary wave. That's humankind is not the end of evolution, but is just an intermediary kind of strand in evolution, and we as humans can consciously participate in that.
Did he talk at all about what he expected to take place after humanity, what the post-human phases were going to be?
Well, it was very much a kind of a speculative way, in the same sense, like one of the metaphors I love a lot is like, let's say, thousands of years ago, imagine that apes were sitting around and just talking, okay, what would it look like if, what will be the next step of evolution? And then some ape would say, well, it's going to be probably some species that's going to be fly into big machines or something, and people are going to, and they're going to communicate through computers or whatever. That would have been unimaginable to kind of have that and to make that understandable. And I think that same step, leap in evolution that Aurobindo is talking about is very hard to imagine by our own minds at this point. But he did make a few kind of statements which I think make a little bit some clarity. It would be a consciousness that is completely aware of its divinity, of the fact that we are some kind of part of a larger whole. And at the same time, still have and are some kind of individuality and some kind of agency within that wholeness, but there is it's called the unity consciousness and awareness of the diversity of all things. So there is definitely a transformation of consciousness happening. What is particularly interesting in his philosophy is that it's not just a transformation of consciousness, but it's also a transformation of matter, and that's where it's really kind of very provocative to say, because what he really said is that we as humans can participate in the transformation of matter, which would mean, in a lot of ways, it's basically transformation of the body. So in that sense, the new being that he was talking about was he called superhuman man, in the way that it would be a different kind of species. It would be a kind of different kind of entity where the body would be also being aware in a way of its divinity. So matter would become alive and express that same kind of consciousness that now is already expressed in a lot of human beings.
You know, that's really remarkable, because there are a lot of completely unspiritual technophiles nowadays who are thinking ahead to what it will mean when we have molecular-sized machines roaming around inside our brains and transforming matter into information processing units. And it sounds like he was describing, you know, their vision of what the future is going to be like. So there's a real convergence of the secular and the spiritual.
There is. It's definitely, I think it's definitely interesting to see that in the last 50 years, there's been so much new discoveries in relation to our evolution, not only our future, but also our past. Just the very fact that it becomes more and more obvious that we're all coming from that same fireball 50 billion years ago, and that since then the universe has been evolving into a planet, and out of this planet, out of this geological event, mind has become aware of itself, reflecting on its past, and therefore also being able to shape its future. And I think the big question is, how is that consciousness that is now in a way out of from remote control, where before kind of like still in the phase of life evolving, there was a sense of consciousness, but it didn't have really any choice which direction to go. Right now, the human being is that consciousness that is becoming aware of itself and is able to participate in the coevolution of itself and of the universe. And therefore, these questions are, I think, are really important questions. The questions are, of course, what kind of direction are we going to take, and how are we going to introduce or incorporate technology in that kind of vision of human being that is really aware of itself as a divine entity. And I think that is maybe really important to kind of stress, that I don't think it's an anti-technology or pro-technology, but how can the technology be integrated as a means to goal of becoming?
So there was a spiritual community around Integral Yoga and Aurobindo, and his successor was named the Mother.
Yeah. So in when Aurobindo came to Pondicherry, then slowly he became surrounded with disciples, and in 1914 and then later 1918, there was a woman that visited him, which was a French artist who lived in Paris around the fin de siècle, 1800-1900, was very much involved in occult practices, had a shamanic teacher in Algeria, and then came with her husband, came to India to visit India and met Aurobindo, and really felt that kind of soul connection. Yes, you are the person that I've been waiting for, and I've seen her actually in my visions, and she never left anymore. And they became really a team. It was an expression of what in Indian philosophy is called, it's on the one count, Purusha and the Shakti. Purusha more the kind of the passive energy, which is masculine in the Indian philosophy, and then the Shakti more the feminine and the action energy. And so both then were responsible for the creation of the ashram, the development of the ashram. Then when Aurobindo passed away, the mother took over, because then at that time she was called the mother, which is in a way it's really a one way of expressing that of that kind of Shakti power, that divine force that moves through all of us, but that she really embodied. And so out of that then, when he died, she kind of slowly started to develop the vision of creating actually a place, not so much an ashram, not a religious community, but actually a place, a city, where this kind of accelerated evolution could happen, accelerated consciousness could happen in a more secular form, in a way.
I'm speaking with Wim Aspaslach. He's an international educator focusing on social justice, ecology, and spirituality, and he currently lives in a village in India called Auroville. That's what we're talking about right now. So Auroville was a vision of the mother in 1966, and how did that come about?
Well, she had the vision, and then really 2 years later it was manifested on the 28th of February 1968. The first stone was laid with the support of the United Nations, with the support of the Indian government. There was soil being brought from about 120 countries represented there to actually create a place that belongs to nobody, where there is an unending learning, where there is a total surrender service to divine consciousness, and really where there is also a place that does not have that sense of belonging in the sense of ownership. And that we'll probably talk more about that, how the economics have then evolved.
It was remarkable how from the very beginning it attracted such an international presence and reputation, because India was well situated in the non-aligned movement, and so there was it was seen as a village that really did represent a kind of global movement of consciousness.
Exactly, and of course, I mean, it was the late 60s. It was 68, so you had a lot of people that really, were looking for alternative ways of living, and found the vision very attractive. Went over there, but then found a kind of a desert, because that's one of the amazing things. I think one of the amazing things about Auroville is that in 68 there was almost no tree there. It was a desert through the erosion, years of erosion and deforestation. So the pioneers, the people who were there, they lived there in very difficult conditions, hot weather, no shelter, and started planting trees, digging holes and planting trees. And that's what's so amazing when you visit the place now. It is an oasis, because it's full of, it's a very rich forest, and with the forest, of course, the birds came back and animals. And so you have a very strong ecological kind of bioregion there, which is wonderful. So from an ecological perspective, it's a beautiful example of a successful restoration project. But of course, there's much more about it.
It was also built to consciously resemble the Milky Way galaxy. Yeah. Well, what was the thinking behind that?
The plan of the city itself, the original plan was called the galaxy model, mm-hmm. where that started from the center, and in the center they built, and the building is now there, and what is called the Mater Mandir, which is the soul of Auroville, and it's a bowl kind of, and inside there is an inner chamber, and it's the meditation hall, and it's one of these places where you walk in and you sit down, and really the mind stops thinking, and it's just a very peaceful experience. Just, you know, you don't have to believe in anything, or you don't have to just kind of, right? It's just going in there and just sitting down. It gives really a sense of peace within oneself. So this is really the place which is at the center of that galaxy model, and then out of that, the whole idea was and is still to develop a series of lines that where their residential areas are evolving from. And then there's also a place where more economic activity is happening, then more cultural activities, and then more an international zone. And so the idea was really to resemble kind of a galaxy model, and therefore also embodying kind of the universality of this particular place, Auroville. Of course, over the years, there has been some kind of changes, or at least the very fact that this galaxy model, of course, was created out of a vision, and then really how do we adapt it to the realities of the place, mm-hmm. is, of course, always a difficult task.
You have to buy the land.
Exactly. That has been always one of the challenges, and especially now has been even more challenged, because one thing what has been happening is that near Auroville is a town called Pondicherry, and Pondicherry has been growing since the last 20 years, a typical Indian city expanding, and so coming closer and closer to Auroville. And so what you also have is a lot of rich Indians say, hey, Auroville looks like a nice place, let's buy some land there. So not all the land was immediately bought, of course, in 68, and so slowly Auroville has been buying the land. Once it becomes from Auroville, then it becomes part of the trust. And so it cannot be sold or speculated on anymore. And right now it is so that I would say about 60% of the area that you would call Auroville is owned by Auroville. 40% is still owned by local farmers and people who still want to hold on to the land, because they feel like maybe the land is going to come up and then I can go up and I can speculate on it. Mm-hmm. But it's still, right now, I think it's a critical movement, because it's really important to have all the land in order to kind of really develop the vision mm-hmm. of Auroville.
There was a leadership transition when the mother died, and eventually the government had to step in and establish a new democratic structure for the Auroville.
Okay, the mother died in the early 70s, 73, 74. And so then suddenly there was no leader. Everybody was kind of like had to, okay, how are we going to do this? At that time then the ashram was taking care of the kind of the legality of it. And there were, in the late 70s, there were some kind of tensions, which then were resolved by giving, in a way, the Indian government, the legal authority, to manage the land. But that's, in a way, in paper. In a way, what really happens right now is that Auroveans are responsible for their development. And there is not really any leadership. That's really so fascinating about Auroville, is that there's no mayor, there's no really anybody that, or no committee that makes all the decisions. But it's really it's really a sense of kind of like an emerging leadership that emerges constantly, collectively. Decisions are made, seeing how they work within large community. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Of course, things are decided therefore much slower than you would have in democracy, or in a voting democracy. But it's really working in this sense, that people are still able to follow their vision, their own personal vision, within the larger vision. Because that's the whole idea, to come there, to work within a particular vision. I want to create a school with alternative learning, ecological farming. You can do it. You can do it. And it works within the larger vision of creating a place of human unity, ecological sustainability, and spiritual unfoldment.
How are resource conflicts mediated, though? If you want to create a school and take resources from the central treasury, and somebody else wants to create a bakery, how is that mediated?
When you would like to start a school, then you would have to go to a committee it's kind of the land designation committee, and write a proposal. So if you would need some funds, you would have to go to another committee to ask for funds. The bakery, you know, would have to also go to these two different places, but right now, there's still enough land for these kind of enterprises. The economic enterprises are called service units, which the idea is that they are becoming self-sustainable. Their income becomes part of the way that they evolve. And then there's part that they also give back, what you would call taxes, which goes in the general fund in order to generate more services, or to actually pay pay people, because the way that Orville works is that people are not really they get a maintenance, monthly maintenance, which is a basic maintenance that is able to provide the basic necessities to live in Orville. But a lot of the services are free in Orville. For example, if you wanna, if you have a neck pain and you need to go to a massage person, you go to a massage person and you don't have to pay for that. That person itself is paid by the central fund to have the service made. So the whole vision of Orville ultimately is that there is no exchange of money. Of course, right now that's not the case. We're, you know, it's not a utopia in the sense that it's perfect, but it definitely, it's a laboratory. It's a laboratorium. It's a place of experience that works towards.
There are an awful lot of international residents there, a lot of Europeans and folks from other parts of the world. What's the balance of that? There's about 1,600 people all total.
Right? Yeah, there's about 1,600 people. The majority, the percentage-wise, are Indians coming from all over India. So that's in the, about 300, 400 Indians. Then you have the large European population is German and French, and then you have representation from different countries in Europe, then from America, and then you have kind of pockets of 3, 4, 5 people from South America, some Russians and Africans. That's one thing that I think is happening in the last few years. We have seen much more an influx of people coming from Africa or South America. And so, which is interesting because, like I said before, the first people who came there were actually pioneers that really worked closely to the land. Now, there's a lot of work done with the land. Now, there are other services that are needed. People may be more into computer engineers or whatever, that kind of another kind of services, other kind of interests that come. And so, you also attract other kind of people.
I'm speaking with Wim Aspaslak. He's an international educator who's been working on ecology, social justice, and spirituality, and currently lives in Auroville in India. You're doing a program to bring students to villages like Auroville.
I'm working for an organization called Living Roots, which is based in Amherst, Massachusetts. And we're providing credit-based college programs that bring students to places called eco-villages, which are villages that are trying to embody sustainable lifestyles ecologically, socially, spiritually. And so one of the programs is the bringing students to India, and where we stay for about 10 weeks in Auroville, and then also visit some other places in India. And the whole idea is for young people, people between 18 and 25, to provide them with alternatives, to other alternative ways of living, so they can actually make informed choices if they really want to go into participating into the consumer production society, or if they really, or if they want to give themselves in other directions and serve kind of for the earth or serve for humanity. So in that sense, it's a very empowering program. I've seen students really wake up to their own abilities to make a change in the world, because that's what's for me been really amazing, that the young people right now, they're very much aware of what's going on, and there is not a lot of alternatives and a lot of information out there that can guide them to find their true ways. And so
besides Auroville, what other villages would they visit on this program?
On this program, we currently go to an eco-village and monastery in France. It's called Plum Village, which is led by a Vietnamese monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. And then we also visit a place in Kerala, which is in western southern state of India, where we visit Mitra Niketan, which is a Gandhian folk school. And so so these are the three main villages that we visit. Then also, as a community, as a student group, we form our own community, our own learning community. So we practice consensus decision making, conflict resolution, open communication, and so it is really a living and learning paradigm kind of education, where there's no separation between learning something and then living it, which is one of the challenges, I think, in education based in universities.
Students can connect to Living Routes online at livingroutes.org. And if they wanted to do that for credit, is that a possibility?
Yeah, the program are credit programs that work through different universities that give credit, but they don't have to be going to that university. So they can, for example, go to the University of Connecticut and apply to this program. So the way they do is, I think the best way is, one way, of course, is going to the website of Living Roots, and that's LivenGroutes at org. .org, or you can call a toll-free number, and that's 888-515-7333, and that's Living Roots, Ecovillage Education.
And Auroville is at auroville.org, right?
Yes, Auroville is at auroville.org, and that's AUROVILLE.org.
And can they email you, Wim, if they're interested in talking to you about it?
Sure. My email is wim@auroville.org.
Very easy. Okay, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Dr. J. It was a pleasure to be in your program. This is a statement that the mother wrote in 1954, a dream. There should be somewhere upon earth a place that no nation could claim as its sole property, a place where all human beings of goodwill, sincere in their aspiration, could live freely as citizens of the world, obeying one single authority, that of the supreme truth. A place of peace, concord, harmony, where all the fighting instincts of man could be used exclusively to conquer the causes of his suffering and misery, to surmount his weakness and ignorance, to triumph over his limitations and incapacities. A place where the needs of the spirit and the care for progress would get precedence over the satisfaction of desires and passions, the seeking for pleasures and material enjoyment. In this place, titles and positions would be supplanted by opportunities to serve and organize. The needs of the body will be provided for equally in the case of each and everyone. In the general organization, intellectual, moral, and spiritual superiority will find expression not in the enchantment of the pleasures and powers of life, but in the increase of duties and responsibilities. Artistic beauty in all forms, painting, sculpture, music, literature, will be available equally to all, the opportunity to share in the joys they bring being limited solely by each one's capacities and not by one's social or financial position. For in this ideal place, money would be no more the sovereign lord. Individual merit will have a greater importance than the value due to material wealth and social position. Work would not be there as the means of gaining one's livelihood. It would be the means whereby to express oneself, develop one's capacities and possibilities, while doing at the same time service to the whole group, which on its side would provide for each one's substance and for the field of his work. In brief, it would be a place where the relations among human beings, usually based almost exclusively upon competition and strife, would be replaced by relations of emulation for doing better, for collaboration, relations of real brotherhood. The Mother, 1954.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.